Cholesterol is the waxy stuff of life that floats through the rivers of our blood veins. To manage this flow of cholesterol, people take $16 billion worth of statin drugs every year. That leads us to ask, should we take statin drugs to manage our cholesterol?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,390th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show and podcast. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Singapore who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, most all of us who want to go on living this good life know there are two kinds of cholesterol floating along in the rivers of our blood veins. There is the good cholesterol, which is called high-density lipoprotein, or HDL, and there is the bad cholesterol, which is low-density lipoprotein, or LDL. Clinical research has shown the higher the amount of HDL and the lower the amount of LDL, the less likely one is to suffer a heart attack or a stroke. Conversely, the one in six of who have the misfortune of low HDL and high LDL have a greater risk of stroke and heart attack. That's what these studies say. Well, given all the research leaking cholesterol levels to heart disease, it was pretty much a given that the pharmaceutical companies would come up with a medication that reduces LDL levels. In the 1980s, they began marketing a whole family of cholesterol-lowering drugs called statins, which work by blocking a liver enzyme that is essential for forming cholesterol. Clinical studies proved that statins do in fact reduce the number of heart attacks in people with high LDL cholesterol, but is it the medication's cholesterol-lowering effect or some other aspect of how the drugs affect the body, such as the anti-inflammatory properties, or even a combination of both that does the trick? No one seems to know for certain. Furthermore, some people can't tolerate the statin side effects, others can't lower their LDL levels with statins alone, and at least one in five people whose LDL levels are managed by statins still have heart attacks or strokes. And so, when the doctors look at us in the eye and then they say, "I think it's time for you to begin taking statins," we are faced with a cholesterol conundrum. Should we begin a lifelong regime of taking a medication that may or may not reduce our risk of heart attack and stroke? Well, who better to ask than Dr. Tobias Yeh, who is a doctor of pharmacy, a doctor of medicine, and the author of the book Clinical Truths, How Not to Be Misled by the FDA, Big Pharma, and Your Doctor. Dr. Yeh, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael.
Up on the mic there. There you go.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you aboard. So you were a doctor of pharmacy, then you made the leap to doctor of medicine, and now an author. Zoom, zoom, zoom. What makes you leap around so quickly here?
Well, I had a spectacular youth and almost suffered from it, as many young people do. I was 19 years old and then a senior in college. And when I graduated at age 20, I didn't know what I wanted to be. I knew that at age 16, I didn't want to be a concert pianist, which I had been for 10 years already.
Yeah, you were running around on music scholarships. That's something.
For 10 years. And
San Francisco Conservatory of Music?
Yes, never paid for lessons and had to play for Aegon Patrie, who's in Wikipedia, and Richard Purvis, who is in Wikipedia. Aegon Patrie was considered one of the world's 25 greatest pianists at the time, and he actually taught a person who many of you are familiar with, Victor Borge.
Wow. There you go.
And I had to play for the guy who taught Victor Borge once a year.
So you went from being a concert pianist to being a doctor. Just like that. No, a doctor of pharmacy.
First. And I was voted third in the class at UC San Francisco Medical Center and one of 12 people they picked from around the country to train to be a professor in 1974. Mm-hmm. I actually took a year out in between because since I graduated college early in 1969, the Vietnam War was going hot and heavy, and I was only one of four brothers to serve in the U.S. Army Active Reserves at the time I was getting my doctorate degree and after at UC San Francisco.
Served at Fort Ord.
I trained and AIT'd at Fort Ord. Based on my test scores, a staff sergeant made me the company clerk, like radar.
So
on
you
MASH.
Did this while you were a soldier, while you were a student, a doctor of pharmacy.
Yes, and I still had a year.
And then you made the transition to medicine. Why did you go from pharmacy to medicine? And what is the difference?
That's a great question. I was never a practicing pharmacist, filling prescriptions except for making money during medical school. I was always a clinical pharmacist and a professor. After I did the extra year of postdoc residency at UC San Francisco, there were five of us that went to the University of Illinois Medical Center in Chicago and started their Doctor of Pharmacy program. And I mentored the guy, Jerry Bauman, who later became dean of the School of Pharmacy.
So while you were there, you got a degree in Doctor of Medicine?
Not at that time. After doing 3 years of being a clinical professor and rounding with the Infectious Diseases Department at the University of Illinois, I decided that I wanted to go back to medical school. Now, what drove this was that we'd already done a study at UC San Francisco showing that 85% of our recommendations to the medical teams at UC San Francisco, one of the top five medical schools in the United States, 85% of our recommendations were followed. But it was difficult for me to not have one out of six of my recommendations not followed.
So when you talk about recommendations as a doctor of pharmacy talking to doctors of medicine, what kind of recommendations were you making to them? Was this about how to use it?
My job, actually, I only had like a 25 hours of actual lecture time teaching to classes of 150 people. The rest of the time I was rounding on the hospital wards, reviewing charts, and making rounds with a group of 20 doctors every Monday, Wednesday, Friday with the infectious disease team at the University of Illinois, whose leader was George G. Jackson, who trained at the Boston City Hospitals under Maxwell Finlan, considered by many to be the father of infectious disease in America. So I learned a lot, of course, about EKGs, X-rays, everything else that went into the decision-making in medicine. And I knew more about drug treatment than these doctors. So we would recommend, we think this might be a better medication or, you know.
Isn't that pretty much what doctors do, is prescribe medicine?
Yes, but
so as a doctor of pharmacy, you probably had a pretty good head start on doctors when it gets right down to it.
A pretty good head start?
Yeah.
Well, that's all we did. And UC San Francisco at the time and has been, and for decades, was the number one pharmacy school in the country. Our dean, Jerry Goyan, was the only pharmacist to become head of the FDA. He took a two-year leave of absence while I was there to run the FDA, and then he returned. So it has been the leading clinical, you know, school of pharmacy in the country.
So you have a pretty good inside track on the world of medicine as we know it today. And so let me ask you this. When I had my most recent blood test and the doctor comes back and says, well, you have an elevated LD. Time for statins. And I said, no, thank you. But why? Why would I say no thank you to a doctor?
Well, and that's a question somebody asked me recently. They said, should I be questioning my doctor? And I told them absolutely yes. And you need to ask your doctor the following questions. I don't know where you got your skepticism about statins. But the first chapter in my book says it's good to be a skeptic. Chapter 3 is dang statistics, because we have to address that big problem in medicine. At the University of California...
Is that like Mark Twain's lies, damn lies, and statistics?
Absolutely. In fact, the FDA, big pharma, and doctors, they hinge their decisions on statistics and statistical significance. And you see that on ads on TV. And then they get rid of the word statistical and they just say significant. And so the doctors are sold and the patients are sold. And the direct-to-patient marketing on television is misleading. And numerous examples in my book tell you how even the prescribing information is misleading. When I was giving a lecture to doctors and I said, here's a graph on dementia, doctors who I saw every week at medicine conference said, and very smart ones, cardiologists, internists, said, Dr. Yeh, is this true of all prescribing information? And I said, yes, unfortunately, it is.
So we really don't know, but there's a good chance, and that's where we're coming from, right?
There's a good chance of what? Being misled.
Of being misled, or there's a good chance of maybe this might work the way we think it might work?
I guarantee you that you are being misled. You are being misled regarding the biggest subjects in medicine, cholesterol, blood pressure, dementia drugs. Just the way the data is presented is misleading. Mm-hmm.
I don't know where I got my skepticism with respect to statins and cholesterol. I think it's just watching as the news floats by. There seems to be a lot of questioning going on these days with respect to cholesterol, LDL, HDL, statins, and a lot of uncertainty. And when I see uncertainty, I'm uncertain too.
There shouldn't be uncertainty. I think the data is very clear. There have been 4 books that I have found written on statins since 2008 at 4-year intervals. And I read the first one.
It's every presidential election, there's a new book on statins.
Well,
right?
Somebody's got to put out a new book. I read the first one by Malcolm Kendrick from England.
Oh, just a sec. We have to take a break. Holy smokes, the time is flying. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain Radio program. My guest, Dr. Tobias Yeh, who is a professor of medicine, of pharmacy, and the author of Clinical Truths, How Not to Be Misled by the FDA, Big Pharma, and Your Doctor. Do stay tuned. We'll be right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about whether we should be taking statins to manage our cholesterol. Ladies and gentlemen, 50% of the men over the age of 60 in the United States take statins. 38% of the women over the age of 60 take statins. And we're just saying, asking today, should we all be taking statins? There seems to be some uncertainty, but not when you ask a doctor. Why are doctors so certain, Dr. Yeh, that we should be taking statins?
Doctors prescribe statins because they've been taught to believe that LDL cholesterol is a good risk predictor of cardiovascular outcomes, which include, as usual, heart attacks, but also strokes and potentially dementia. Mm-hmm. But it's very clear, as I was saying, every 4 years a book gets written. I read the book, The Great Cholesterol Con by Malcolm Kendrick, and I've actually emailed him, and we sent some stuff back and forth. He's very interested in my book, because my book doesn't only address statins. Cardiovascular is only one chapter.
It addresses just about everything. it's like an encyclopedia of questions you would like to ask your doctor.
That's what it is. Oh. It's 600 pages, single space at the present time, in type 14 font to be easy to read for us elderly people. And it's listed as a question, a short answer, and then an expansion, which is all referenced.
There you go. Now, why would a doctor be so certain? Because it's almost like they have to say, you have to take statins. Otherwise, they'll get thrown in jail or something like that.
Well, actually, they won't get thrown in jail, but they might lose their job. Here's the problem. And I tell you how to do this. And that's why the book is titled How to Not Be Misled, because I tell you how to apply. What's in my book is an approach of how to apply what we're going to learn today to any drug, past, present, or future.
Be it statins or whatever.
It doesn't matter.
Fair enough.
And when you ask your doctor, here's the key. When you ask your doctor, how many patients do you have to treat with Lipitor, generic atorvastatin, or Crestor, generic rosuvastatin, to help one person avoid some cardiovascular event, whether it's chest pain, angina.
Okay, you're asking, how many patients do you have to treat to get one to work for you?
Exactly.
How many?
The doctors don't know the answer to this question. I ask them all the time.
Because they don't know?
Do you know how many patients you have to treat? They go, no. Because that's not given in the studies. Some studies now, more recent ones, might give you that. But that's known as a number needed to treat.
Yeah.
And with these drugs, whether it be Lipitor or Crestor, atorvastatin or rosuvastatin, they have to treat 100 people to help one person. This is mind-blowing.
1%. 1%.
Yes. Now, how do I arrive at that number? It's not a number that I invented. It's a well-known number, and it's very easy to calculate, but it's not given in the studies. What's given in the studies is the absolute percent difference between the drug and the placebo groups in a large trial, say.
Those who take the drug and those who take a placebo.
Exactly.
Okay.
And if the difference was 2% versus 1%, as it was in the Crestor study, you divide that number into 100.
There you go.
So it's 100 people to treat one person. In the Lipitor study, the ASCOT trial was the first study in the drug literature. in the manufacturer's literature. The numbers I give you all come from the manufacturer's literature and the study.
That's who tests drugs. It's not the federal government that tests drugs. It's the people who manufacture the drugs that test drugs. Just like in agriculture, it's not the federal government who tests pesticides or herbicides or anything of that nature. It's always the manufacturer.
Because the companies fund the study. Now, sometimes the National Institutes of Health will donate money, and of course, to the universities, and this is a major problem too, because there's an uproar right now about what's happening in the government and cutting back on research, researchers at the NIH. But you have to keep in mind that the reason why they're in an uproar is because it's how they make their living, is publishing studies. That's how people in academia get promoted. Based on the number of studies that they've published.
Given all of this uncertainty, what, 1%?
Yes.
Good, you treat 100 people and you help one?
Yes.
Okay, why is the doctor so certain that I or anybody else above the age of 60 should be taking statins?
Because they believe what the American Heart Association is putting out there, that pretty much everybody over the age of 40 needs to be taking statins. And if you look at the adult population in America, okay, and adults, anybody over 18, that's 320 million people in the last census in America, okay? And they're going to come up with a new recommendation that is going to get rid of LDL cholesterol as a risk calculator. And this is going to drop the recommendations for people to take statins by many, many millions of people. I give you the number in my book.
Wow. So the American Heart Association, of course, was very famous for recommending that we get off animal fats and start eating grains. And we get off of animal fats and start eating margarine instead of butter. And doing all of these things that umpteen million years of evolution would suggest that we shouldn't, but we did. And it's really changed the body physique of America that we get on these heavy carbohydrate diets. And so I don't know, maybe that's one of the reasons why I was skeptical of my doctor's recommendation that I get on statin.
So you talk about physique, so that brings in another problem. So let me just finalize the LDL question. LDL cholesterol is a poor predictor of cardiovascular outcomes.
Quick summation here. LDL, low density lipoprotein, is bad. HDL, high-density lipoprotein, is good. So with using drugs or something, you can manipulate the ratio of LDL and HDL and live happily ever after.
Not true.
Not true.
LDL is not bad by itself. And the problem with treating with drugs is it gives a doctor and the patient something to do. They go, oh, look, my level's dropping. I must be doing good. But here's the bottom line. It gives them something to do, costs you money, means more blood testing, but here's the bottom line. At 16-year follow-up, 15.7 to be exact, of treating patients, a 15.7-year follow-up, of Lipitor, atorvastatin, there's no difference in overall mortality.
Wait a minute.
And even during the 3.3...
Is this for people who took the statins and those who did not?
Yes. During the 3.3 years of the study, there was no difference in overall mortality between people who took Lipitor and people who didn't. And then at follow-up, 15.7 years later, there was no difference in overall mortality. And in the journal Stroke, at 21-year follow-up, there was no difference in stroke or dementia, even though your doctor is going to recommend you take a statin to decrease your stroke risk. But here's the bottom line, and it's in my book. You should not be using LDL cholesterol as a risk factor for stroke risk. You should be using the National Institutes of Health stroke risk calculator, which does not have LDL cholesterol.
Wow.
Okay. So you might say, what should I be using, doctor? And let me tell you.
What should I be using, doctor?
Okay, because this is the way my book is laid out.
All right.
I tell you, there are other fats in the blood. ApoA, ApoB, LP little a, for which there's no treatment or investigation only. But okay, even these aren't important.
Let me tell you. Wonderful questions in this book. And let me
tell you what you should be using.
Okay.
Total divided by HDL. And you all get this in your report already. Look at your lipid panel report. The total divided by HDL. And the risk factor, depends on the laboratory, is going to be 4.5 to 5, a ratio. Mm-hmm. This is called the risk ratio. So here's one of the questions I pose in my book.
So what's a bad ratio?
Anything over 5, 4.5 or 5, depending on the laboratory normals for the laboratory that did your test.
Okay.
So here's a great question I have in my book. Doctor, or this is the question posed for the people who read the book. Who is at a greater risk? Somebody with a total cholesterol of 300 or somebody with a total cholesterol of 210? I'm going to make it easy for calculation purposes.
So,
what does a normal person think?
I don't know.
What would you guess?
Well, I would scratch my head and say I don't have the slightest idea.
But would most people think that if you had a total cholesterol,
you would probably think the lower would be best, right?
And you would be wrong. Here's the reason why. Women often have, and you women know this, women often have an HDL of 90 or 100, 110, and their total's 300. What's 300 divided by 100?
Oh, 3.
Men might have...
Which is very low.
Men might have a total of 210, but their HDL is 30.
So
what is that ratio?
Yeah.
7.
Bad.
So the guy with the lower total cholesterol is at more than double the risk. Hmm. This is the best usable present day calculation of risk.
Well, this is totally upending the entire LDL, HDL paradigm then, correct?
And it should. So just use the total divided by HDL, which you all already have in your lipid panel results. Let me give you the example. My doctor knows that I'm against LDL cholesterol treatment. So my wife last fall goes in for her annual physical.
I guess that means you're not taking statins.
No. By the way, in me, statins made me pre-diabetic in 2007, and I went off, and I've never been pre-diabetic since because statins cause diabetes. And I can give you the numbers on that. But let's finish this total HDL risk ratio business. So my wife goes in last fall. My doctor knows that I'm against treating LDL cholesterol and not looking at the total HDL risk ratio. So she tells my wife, well, your LDL cholesterol is high. I know your husband is against it, and she knows me, and she wants my book, of course. Everybody wants my book, all the doctors I know that I've lectured to. And she says, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to order an ultrasound of your neck carotid arteries as a surrogate marker.
So we'll see if there's any plugging going on there.
Exactly, plaques.
Mm-hmm.
In to as a surrogate marker for what might be happening in your heart. Because heart attacks still kill 50% of people in America, and the AARP publication says, despite 75 years of research, it's still killing 50% of America. And do you know what the bottom line is? It's still going to kill 50% of Americans.
Regardless of all of the statins that we take.
Exactly. Because it's not that simple.
Wow. Well, because life is much more complex.
Oh, it's always more complex. And I'm going to give you the site to check out the complexity. But basically, my wife's carotids were clean.
And they're, even though her indicators were not
very her good. Indicator, according to what doctors believe, was high and needed treatment. But here's a problem, as I mentioned. Okay, so the FDA is a problem. Big Pharma can be a problem, even though I've lectured for them, five companies, but I've
lectured. Well, they sell.
Well, I've lectured for them on infections and vaccines, mm-hmm. okay? But I've lectured on my own about every subject in medicine. And doctors are powerless to help you. Why? Because if the doctor doesn't recommend something, they could lose their job. I told my doctor, this is what happens. You have to recommend, because there's best practice. You have to recommend this to me and then document that I refuse your recommendation. And then you won't get fired.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Dr. Tobias Yeh. He's the author of Clinical Truths, How to Not Be Misled by the FDA, Big Pharma, and your doctor as well. Well, I said no thank you to my doctor. I worry. Did I do the right thing? Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Court Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org. The food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org. Farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freeze. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute!" In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream, and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. ordered your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. Yes, we do have a little bit of time left. So we have some very important turf to cover. Before we close the last segment, Dr. Yeh was discussing how it takes 100 patients to get one positive result from the use of Lipitor or from any statin drug, I think. And then what happens with the 99 people that are not do not benefit by the protection of the statin drug, Dr. Yeh?
So then they want you to take a drug like Repatha or Praluent, which Repatha, the FDA committee voted not to approve it, but the commissioner overrode it, since he's equivalent to the president. And here's the interesting thing about Repatha. How many patients does a doctor have to treat with Repatha? Tell one person. And again, you go back to the original study, which is what I always do. I go back to the original study, which is what the drug manufacturers use to get the drug approved. Often in the leading journal in medicine, the New England Journal of Medicine, which has made some major mistakes in the past, and which they admit to. And the difference between the drug and a placebo group for Repatha was 2% versus 1%. That means they have to treat the other 99 with another drug for which they have to treat 100 people, and they're only going to help one person.
So how on earth does a drug get approved that only helps one in 100 people?
Because what happens is, this is the whole thing, and you started with statistics. Because in medicine, as long as it reaches a p-value of less than 0.05, which means, this comes from this bell-shaped curve of the normal statistical distribution, and if you take the 2.5% on each end, that equals 5%, 0.05, 5 out of 100. They're saying that that's the chance that those results happen by chance. But here's the problem with these cardiovascular drugs. The p-value always hinges solely on the number of patients studied. So with all these cardiovascular drugs, it is never going to be statistically significant, according to their calculations.
Unless you can get a significant...
Until they get 12, 15,000, 17,000 patients, which was the CRESTOR study, the Jupiter trial, published in the New England Journal of Medicine as a lead article. When you get to that large number of patients, you're going to show a statistically significant difference when it's actually a very small absolute difference.
Okay. There are lies, damn lies, and statistics, so said Mark Twain, and it's easy to make them that way. Goodness sakes. So here we are. Yours truly, for example, like many other people, go to the doctor. Oh, you have an elevated LDL. It's time for statin drugs. And for some reason, I just said, no, thank you. And I have a sense that I treat my body with food supplements, which are food. Medicine, I do not take any medicine, because medicine, I think, changes the physiology of your body. Statins, for example, change the physiology of your liver so that it doesn't produce as much LDL. So that's a physical change in your body.
Caveat. Foods and supplements change the physiology of your body.
Yes, but in ways your body recognizes.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
For example, there was a doctor, Dr. Joe Wallach, on KSCO. Mm-hmm. He pushed selenium. Selenium was only shown to be not enough levels of not high enough levels in a single Chinese province, Keishan. People who take selenium and vitamin E supplements, and I document this, actually increase their risk for prostate cancer, men.
Okay. There you go.
People who take zinc.
I stand corrected then.
People who take zinc supplements can knock copper off the binding sites in their body and cause damage to their spinal cord and dementia.
There you go.
It's copper is a trace mineral. Zinc, you don't need that much. We've seen this. And there is a copper deficiency anemia, which even the hematologist, cancer specialist in town, forgot. When I mentioned it to him, he goes, oh, I forgot about that. Right? Copper deficiency as a cause of anemia. And it was caused by a person in town here in Santa Cruz who was taking zinc supplementation. Because zinc is a +2 charge, copper is a +2 charge. So the zinc, so much of it, knocked copper off its binding sites. So they introduce a copper deficiency, which causes anemia and causes the same kind of spinal cord damage as you see in B12 deficiency, which normally takes you 3 to 5 years to run out, unless you're a vegan or unless you take nitrous oxide and abuse that. Then you can cause spinal cord damage and dementia in a short amount of time.
As a doctor of pharmacy, as a doctor of medicine, as the author of a book on what... How not to get into trouble with medicine, essentially. Clinical truths, how not to be misled by the FDA, Big Pharma, and your doctor. Everybody seems to be out to mislead us. Or am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. even the people who have supplements to sell you. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I address is the heart surgeon who wants to sell you a supplement based on his research and learning about these so-called blue zones. Okay. These blue zones don't really, they're false. That got the Ig Nobel, Nobel Award in 2020. Ig Nobel. This is given by MIT. Oh, it's a play on the words ignoble, which means dishonest in character or purpose. And the Nobel Peace Prize and the Ig Nobel Awards are given by actual Nobel Prize winners at the presentation. And the blue zone is based on fiction and fraud. These aren't the highest living people in the world.
That would be carrying on a great tradition of the snake oil salesman of the wild, wild west. Right?
Right, but this is a heart surgeon, retired, who now wants to sell you his thing. Sure. And the blue zone people want to sell you their thing. Because they say it's diet, right? And those aren't the longest-lived people in the world. The fraud is because this data comes from people who are committing pension fraud and 100-year-old people who were counted as alive who were actually dead.
Well, it sounds like our tax rules or IRS rules.
Social Security
rules.
Absolutely.
So we have a few minutes left, Dr. Tobias Ye, what can we do to manage our heart and our cardiovascular system as people? What can we do? What can we eat? Can we exercise and so on? What is it that you would recommend people do? You're not going to recommend statins, which I will take that recommendation myself, and I have.
Right.
But what should I do? What should everybody else do so that we can somehow live a long and happy life?
I think a moderate amount of exercise is fine if you enjoy it. Too much exercise actually increases your risk for atrial fibrillation. The abnormal heartbeat that can occur in 40-year-olds because of too much exercise, it increases the risk for stroke. I think diet-wise, mostly eat what you enjoy. Perhaps
Hostess Twinkies?
Well, no. That's never been high in the Chinese diet.
No.
I think processed foods are not a good idea. I think that when you, since you raised the question of butter or margarine, perhaps
butter and margarine,
off.
Yeah.
What I do is I look at fats and I say that if it's a solid at room temperature, it's your body's higher than room temperature, but it's the more solid it is, the more likely it is to be solid in your body.
Ah.
That's a clue. That's a clue to saturation of fats.
There you go. That's a,
if it's liquid,
is a very good recommendation right there.
Because I understand chemistry.
So butter would be melted.
So it's probably a little bit's okay. Butter's not big on the Chinese diet either. But let me tell you about what you need to mostly do is relax. You're not in control of the big picture. My wife's grandmother lived to be 112, and she died of pneumonia. She would have lived longer.
112. Japanese.
Now, do the Japanese eat teriyaki beef? Yes. Do they eat chicken? Yes. Now, what is high in them actually is stomach cancer, but I think that could be from too much barbecued stuff because the teriyaki and coal tars are a known carcinogen. You can cause skin cancer in mice by painting their skin, which has been shaved, with coal tar, and it'll cause skin cancer. So too much barbecued stuff is not good. Yeah, I had a Filipino friend who died at age 60 of stomach cancer, and she and her husband used to barbecue all the time. I think, you know, every now and then, no problem. Do red meats cause colon cancer? That's an association. You know, it's not proof. So much of what you hear on the news and what I see is association. So much of what I see, and
what
I tell
you. What
do you
mean by association?
It's correlation. It's not cause and effect.
A lot of people eat red meat. A lot of people get.
No. I don't believe what I see on television or hear on the radio. Because those doctors.
Except for the show, right?
Well, this is the first time I've been on the show, and I believe myself. because I see so much, you know, everybody does YouTube music and stuff, and these people cut in with their ads for this, that, or other. Mm-hmm. And some of it is total BS and misleading, you know. And the doctors you see on television, they're just mouthpieces. They're just mouthpieces for the companies. Yeah.
They put on a white cloak and have a stethoscope.
They don't do the research and dig into the facts. They have people helping them to find out what happens. But so much of what you see on TV actually is press releases from the company that made the drug.
Well, Dr. Yeh, if I go to my doctor and the doctor sees an elevated LDL, he says, okay, Michael Olson, it's time for statins. What else could he say?
He can't because he would be fired from his job.
So he has to say
he has
that.
To. Right, because there's best practice in medicine, just like there is best practice in every industry. And I state in my book, best practice can be worst practice. But the doctor has to do that because the people who review his care, his employers will say, hey, you're not recommending statins for this elevated LDL. And the American Heart Association says you're supposed to be. You're not conforming.
So somehow over the years, the fact that LDL must be diminished in your body and the HDL must be elevated came into play. That's what the established wisdom holds. And therefore, that wisdom goes to all of the doctors via med school and via pharmacists and via pharmaceutical companies. It becomes the established wisdom. And if you go against that wisdom.
Your doctor's not going to be happy with you, but you can tell them. But first, I think the doctors need educating, just like we do. You should ask your doctor, how many patients are you treating with this drug to help one? And You should also ask them, doctor, how many patients are you treating and you're going to give them diabetes? Because in the 3.3 years of the Lipitor trial, one out of 250 people is going to get diabetes. In the 1.9 years of the Crestor trial, one out of 167 people is going to get diabetes. So and that's a bad disease. Some diabetes is worse than some cancers.
So that is my problem with medications and probably supplements too. If you take a medication for one thing to fix one thing, you mess up something else. You push down here and it pops up over there, and pretty soon you're out of trouble for one thing and in trouble for another thing.
And sometimes doctors have prescribed a medication to treat an adverse reaction from the first medicine they prescribed. And it's like treating you with a medicine, and then maybe you get hospitalized. That's your problem with your blood pressure. You get hospitalized, and once you enter the hospital, your risk of having adverse events, they estimate somewhere between 100,000 to 200,000 people in this country die every year in the hospital as a result of medical errors.
That is the wisdom of Dr. Tobias Yeh, who is the author of Clinical Truths, How to Not Be Misled by the FDA, Big Pharma, and Your Doctor. And he is a doctor, and he is a pharmacist, and pretty much everything else as well. Musician, classical piano. Dr. Yeh, thank you for joining us, and thank you all for tuning in out there. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson.